New York, this is Democracy Now!
The year 1619 marks the year that the first Africans were sold into the colony of Virginia. And through this series of essays, we really argue that very little about modern American life has been left untouched by this foundational institution.
Today, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones on her new book, The 1619 Project, based on the groundbreaking New York Times series about the legacy of slavery in the United States. We'll talk about the project as well as right-wing attacks on her and efforts to ban the teaching of The 1619 Project and critical race theory.
I realized that that date was foundational, and yet no one had ever thought to teach us that date. And it really symbolized to me both how long Black people had been in this country, how foundational slavery was to America, and also the power of erasure about who gets to decide what dates and what stories are important and what dates and what stories get left out.
Nicole Hannah-Jones will join us from her home state of Iowa, where she's taking part in a homecoming event in Waterloo tonight with the high school teacher who first introduced her to the date 1619 as the year a ship carrying enslaved people first arrived in what's now the United States. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A jury in Brunswick, Georgia, is set to determine the fate of three white men charged with hunting down and murdering 25-year-old black jogger Ahmaud Arbery. Lawyers for the defense made closing arguments Monday. A nearly all-white panel of 12 jurors and three alternates is set to hear a rebuttal from prosecutors today before beginning deliberations. Defense attorney Laura Hoag, who represents Greg Michael, the former police officer, blamed Arbery's own actions for his death, and she drew outrage over these comments.
Turning Ahmaud Arbery into a victim after the choices that he made does not reflect the reality of what brought Ahmaud Arbery to Sotilla Shores. In his khaki shorts, with no socks to cover his long, dirty toenails.
Hoag's comment drew audible gasps from the courtroom. Ahmaud Arbery's mother, Wanda Cooper Jones, was so upset she got up and briefly left the trial. She later condemned Hoag's remarks.
She described Ahmaud as his long legs and his dirty, long toenails. That was just a beyond rude. Regardless of what kind of toenails he had, what size legs he had, that was still my son. And my son actually was running for his life.
Taken together, Gregory McMichael, his son Travis McMichael, and William Bryan face 9 counts that could see each of them sentenced to life in prison. In Yemen, the Saudi-led military coalition has launched air raids on the capital, Sana'a, with reports of massive explosions in Sana'a's northern neighborhoods. Saudi officials said they targeted Houthi military sites in retaliation for the rebel group's drone attack Saturday on sites in Saudi Arabia, including a major oil hub in Jeddah. The latest violence comes after thousands of people marched through the streets of Sana'a on Monday, protesting U.S. support for the Saudi-led military coalition.
We, the Yemeni people, took to the streets today to denounce the military escalation carried out by America, the economic blockade, and the continuation of aggression. We had thought that when Joe Biden took office, he would keep his promises on stopping the war in Yemen and open the airport in Sana'a. It turned out that all that talk was a lie.
In Washington, D.C., a bipartisan group of senators has introduced a bill that would block the Biden administration's planned sale of $650 million worth of weapons to Saudi Arabia. Republicans Rand Paul and Mike Lee joined independent Senator Bernie Sanders as co-sponsors in a statement. Senator Paul said, quote, "By participating in this sale, we would not only be rewarding reprehensible behavior, but also exacerbating a humanitarian crisis in Yemen," unquote. The United Nations warns the Saudi-led invasion of Yemen and naval blockade has led to the worst humanitarian disaster in half a century, with millions displaced and a step away from starvation. U.S. coronavirus infections and hospitalizations are continuing to rise, even as COVID-19 continues to claim more than 1,000 lives per day. Cases among children are up 32% from 2 weeks ago, representing about a quarter of all U.S. infections. On Monday, top infectious disease expert Dr. Anthony Fauci called on everyone 5 and older to get vaccinated, warning the Thanksgiving holiday could trigger a dangerous winter surge unless people take measures now to slow the spread of coronavirus. Meanwhile, the White House said Monday 95% of federal workers have met a vaccine mandate covering 3.5 million U.S. government employees. And the CDC added Germany and Denmark to a list of high-risk destinations amidst a massive surge of COVID cases across most of Europe. In occupied East Jerusalem, Israeli soldiers shot dead a Palestinian man after he killed an Israeli settler and wounded 3 others Sunday. The confrontation took place in the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, the site of recent attacks from Israeli police. In a statement, Hamas said the Palestinian man was politically affiliated with the armed resistance movement in the Gaza Strip. Israeli forces immediately raided the refugee camp where he lived in retaliation and arrested several of his family members, including his daughter. In El Salvador, President Nayib Bukele has announced plans to build the world's first Bitcoin city in the eastern coastal region of La Union. Bukele said the city would be financed by cryptocurrency bonds and would harness geothermal power from a volcano. Many opponents say a Bitcoin city would likely lead to further displacement and other catastrophic impacts on local communities. This is Salvador's president speaking Sunday.
It's going to be right there in the Fonseca Gulf, and it's going to include everything, residential areas, commercial areas, services, museums, entertainment, bars, restaurants, airport, port, rail, everything devoted to Bitcoin.
Bukele's announcement comes despite massive opposition to Bitcoin in El Salvador, which is also the first country in the world to declare the cryptocurrency as legal tender. Meanwhile, several civil society groups critical of Bukele's government were raided by the Salvadoran National Police Monday. The widespread raids targeted feminist humanitarian aid and other social justice groups. In Wisconsin, police say the man charged with plowing his SUV into a parade of Christmas revelers was involved in a domestic disturbance just minutes before Sunday's attack, which killed 5 people and injured 48 others. Waukesha Police Chief Daniel Thompson on Monday identified the driver as 39-year-old Darryl Brooks of Milwaukee.
The subject was taken into custody a short distance from the scene, and we are confident he acted alone. There's no evidence that this is a terrorist incident.
Brooks has a criminal record that includes arrest for sexual abuse, battery, and domestic abuse. He was arrested earlier this month, accused of running over the mother of his child with a vehicle in a gas station parking lot on November 2nd, and released on a $1,000 cash bond just 5 days before Sunday's deadly assault. The House panel investigating the January 6th Capitol insurrection has subpoenaed 5 more allies of former President Trump, including longtime Republican operative Roger Stone. At least 6 people who were part of the mob that entered the Capitol reportedly worked as security for Stone and were linked to the far-right Oath Keepers militia group. Also subpoenaed was Alex Jones, the far-right conspiracy theorist and InfoWars host. This month, Jones was found liable for damages in lawsuit brought by families of the 20 children killed in the Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre. For years, Jones spread false reports that the shooting was a government hoax and the victims' families were paid actors, resulting in online harassment and death threats for Sandy Hook families. For the first time ever, The U.S. has been added to a list of backsliding democracies. This year's annual report from the International Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance cites voter suppression in many U.S. states, runaway political polarization, and former President Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election. Meanwhile, a United Nations human rights expert has denounced Republican voter suppression efforts, saying partisan gerrymandering and new restrictions on voting are undermining democracy by denying communities of color an equal right to vote. This is Fernand de Varenne, the UN Special Rapporteur on Minority Issues, speaking Monday.
It is almost a tyranny of the majority, where minority's right to vote is being denied in many areas, in many parts of the country, and that this cannot be a positive development. This cannot be consistent with the fundamental values of democracy, and certainly it does not seem to be consistent with the United States' international human rights obligations.
President Joe Biden Monday renominated Jerome Powell to serve as chair of the Federal Reserve. Powell was first appointed to the post by former President Trump in 2018.
When our country was hemorrhaging jobs last year and there was panic in our financial markets, Jay's steady and decisive leadership helped to stabilize markets and put our economy on track to a robust recovery.
During his tenure, Powell has refused to acknowledge the climate crisis and has a record of weakening Wall Street regulations. Massachusetts Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren has vowed not to confirm Powell, calling him a, quote, dangerous man to head up the Fed. New York State's Assembly has found overwhelming evidence that former Governor Andrew Cuomo engaged in sexual harassment while in office. The investigation, which took 8 months to complete, largely corroborated a damning report by New York Attorney General Letitia James, finding Cuomo sexually harassed at least 11 women. Cuomo resigned in August, even as he continued to deny the allegations. And the state of Florida has officially exonerated four African-American men falsely accused of raping a white woman near Groveland, Florida, in 1949. Two of the so-called Groveland Four were brutally murdered as a result of the false accusations. The case is now seen as a racially charged miscarriage of justice emblematic of the Jim Crow South. Carol Greenlee is the daughter of Charles Greenlee, who was sentenced to life in prison over the false accusations. She spoke to Democracy Now! In January of 2019, just after Florida Republican Governor Ron DeSantis granted posthumous pardons.
My nieces, my nephews, my brothers, my son all carried this cloud over them. It has lifted that cloud from being carried by innocent children, innocent family members. And I feel that a chain has been broken. It felt like the door of justice swung open and the nightmare ended of torture, waking up in night to the pain of what had happened to my father.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Coming up, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones on the 1619 Project. Stay with us.
Then shook your hand with gloves. You watched her pass away. The words she said were faint. Closed our eyes for a while. I still see sundress smile.
Sandra Gorgeous Smile by Blood Orange, Sandra in the title is Sandra Bland. It also mentions Sabrina Fulton, the mother of Trayvon Martin. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, we begin today's show with Nicole Hannah-Jones, the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter who covers racial injustice for The New York Times Magazine. She's the creator of the landmark 1619 Project, which reframes U.S. history by marking the year 1619, when the first enslaved Africans arrived on Virginia soil as the country's foundational date. This month, two new books that she co-edited are out. The 1619 Project, A New Origin Story, and an adaptation for children titled Born on the Water. It was on the 400th anniversary of the first enslaved Africans landing in Colonial Virginia in 1619 that the New York Times Magazine launched the 1619 Project as a special issue in 2019. It's now been expanded as an anthology of 18 essays, along with poems and short stories that examine the legacy of slavery, dedicated to the more than 30 million descendants of American slavery. Many argue the 1619 Project has changed how history is taught and discussed in the United States. Just last year, then-President Donald Trump announced his proposed 1776 commission at the National Archives Museum in Washington, D.C. last year in direct response to the 1619 Project.
Critical race theory, the 1619 Project, and the crusade against American history is toxic propaganda. Ideological poison that, if not removed, will dissolve the civic bonds that tie us together, will destroy our country. That is why I recently banned trainings in this prejudiced ideology from the federal government and banned it in the strongest manner possible.
Many states have banned the teaching of the 1619 Project as part of the right-wing attacks on critical race theory in schools. Earlier this year, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where Nicole Hannah-Jones went to graduate school, initially denied her tenure even after it was unanimously approved by the faculty. The board typically rubber stamps tenure for professors who win such approval from their peers, and it reversed the decision after protests from alumni, faculty, and students, and ultimately offered Nicole Hannah-Jones tenure. But she declined, instead announced she would join the faculty at Howard University, one of the country's most prestigious historically black universities, and helped launch the Center for Journalism and Democracy. Tonight, Nicole Hannah-Jones will visit her high school alma mater in Waterloo, Iowa, where she'll talk about her two new books with her former teacher, Reverend Ray Dial, who is the teacher who first introduced her to the date 1619 as the year a ship carrying enslaved people first arrived in what's now the United States. She writes that when she first read the date, it appeared to be glowing three-dimensional numbers rising from the page as an exhilarating revelation started to sink in. Nicole Hannah-Jones, welcome back to Democracy Now! Congratulations on your new books as you join us from Des Moines on your way to Waterloo. Can you talk about that moment in high school? What a difference a high school teacher makes.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for having me on. Mr. Ray Dial is the teacher who changed my life. He's the teacher who both introduced me to how vast Black history was, even though we hadn't been taught hardly any of it. And he's also the teacher who introduced me or suggested that I join my high school newspaper and write the stories that I wanted to see. So I opened the preface for the new 1619 book with that because that was a transformative moment for me. I had no idea that Black Americans had been here this long, that we had a lineage that went back almost as long as the English people who got all the credit for it. And that number stood in to me for an erasure and really made me understand as a young, 15 or 16 year old, that the history we're taught is not necessarily what's the most important things or all there is to know, but it's what someone has determined that we should know, and that there's so much more out there, particularly if you are members of marginalized communities, that never gets into the histories we tell ourselves. And that erasure is very powerful.
Could you talk about the 1690 project itself? It's comprised of 18 essays and 36 poems and works of fiction. Talk about your decision to use this format to tell the story.
Yes. So the 1619 Project, A New Origin Story, the book, is an expanded version of the original project that published in August of 2019. So all of the original essays that were in that first project have all been significantly expanded. And then we've added 8 additional essays written by a range of some of the nation's most renowned historians, from Dr. Carol Anderson to Martha Jones to Dr. Dorothy Roberts. Dr. Martha Jones, sorry. And they're covering a range of subject areas such as Indian removal and settler colonialism, citizenship, the creation of race, the Second Amendment. And so it's really giving an even broader understanding of how the legacy of slavery shapes our modern society. And then in addition to that, we've also doubled the poetry and short fiction that was in the original project in what we call a literary timeline. So we ask some of the great American writers to reimagine all of these periods in American history involving Black people and race, and to write them from a Black perspective. And it's actually one of the most profound and powerful parts of the book. And then the third aspect of the book are these archival photos that launch every essay. So the photos are of regular Black people, not famous people, through time, from the beginning of photography all the way until, a couple years ago. And it's a way of forcing the reader to pause and consider the humanity of these 31 million descendants of American slavery, that all to really focus that everything that you're going to read about, all of the brutality, all of the horrors, all the violence, but also all of the resilience, all the love, happened to real people. So I think that the format is it's beautiful and it's powerful, and people are, I hope, will get a great deal from it.
And at the core of the book is an attempt, obviously, to link the past to the present. Could you talk about how we continue to see the legacy of slavery in current U.S. institutions, whether it's the government itself, the education, housing?
Absolutely. So the entire premise of the 1619 Project is that the legacy of slavery was not banished along with the institution of slavery in 1865. That slavery is one of the oldest institutions in our society. The English settled Jamestown in 1607. And by 1619, just 12 years later, they're engaging in African slavery. So that is 150 years before they even decide that they want to become their own country. And that slavery shaped everything, nearly everything, about the country that would ultimately be established. So, for instance, we have an essay on citizenship, which talks about the 14th Amendment and how the reason that we have birthright citizenship in the United States, where every person born on this soil is an automatic citizenship, is because Black Americans generationally were not citizens of this country, even though they were born here. And after the end of slavery, they pushed very hard for a constitutional amendment that would guarantee them citizenship and all people born on the soil citizenship. So we can thank Black Americans for that. It talks about the creation of race and how these ideas of an inherent race and that one race is superior to another, and the fact that on every single form that we have for the government, we have to choose a race, including our birth certificate, our marriage certificate, our death certificate, that is also a legacy of 1619. We have an article that talks about the Second Amendment. That's by Dr. Carol Anderson out of Emory, and really argues that our obsession with guns, we have more guns than almost any society in the world. And we have the highest rates of gun violence. And that is also a legacy of slavery, that the Second Amendment, while we like to think of it as being allowing citizens to form militias to ward off government tyranny, it also was allowing them to form militias to suppress slave rebellions, because enslaved people were constantly rebelling. And it looks at why someone like Philando Castile in Minneapolis, who is a legal gun carrier, can be killed for carrying a gun, and whether or not Black people really do have a right to bear arms in this nation. So every single essay in the book really makes this modern connections. And what we hope is slavery has influenced our society in so many ways, but we've really invisibilized that. We've lost that connection and understanding. And what I argue for the project is the narrative of 1776 does not explain the insurrection on the Capitol in January. It doesn't explain George Floyd and why a white police officer could feel that he could kill a man in front of witnesses and would not have to worry about facing any consequences. And it certainly doesn't explain why we have a political party right now that is trying to instate minority rule. That is the legacy of 1619.
Nicole, your work has become the target of right-wing backlash. Last year, the Trump administration threatened to pull federal funding from schools that use the 1619 Project in their curriculum. Tennessee's Education Commissioner, Penny Schwinn, recently signed an emergency measure to regulate the topic of race and gender in classrooms that includes financial penalties for educators who violate the law. This is after Tennessee's Republican governor signed a law prohibiting critical race theory from being taught in the state's schools. And then you've got other states, including North Dakota, Tennessee, Florida, Idaho, and Texas, that have passed similar laws. I want to play a clip of Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott signing into law the 1836 Project earlier this year. The name is a reference to the 1619 Project and marks the year Texas seceded from Mexico.
The 1836 Project promotes patriotic education about Texas and ensures that the generations to come understand Texas values.
Now, you and others responded to the announcement of the 1836 Project by highlighting the fact that Texas had fully legalized slavery in its constitution and was guilty at the time of lynching Black and Mexican Texans. If you could talk about this movement around the country, what it means for history of the United States and for what children and everyone learns.
Yes. So, I think it's quite revealing that the argument is if we teach a truer history that actually reflects the facts of what happened, that will raise children not to love their country. I think that says a great deal about what we actually think about how much this country has lived up to the idea of exceptionalism. If a patriotism has to be based on propaganda that really diminishes and tries to erase from memory of the difficult parts of our past, it doesn't seem like that is a genuine patriotism. But I think that we should all, as Americans, be deeply, deeply concerned about these anti-history laws, because what they're really attempting to do is control our memory and to control our understanding of our country. When Texas seceded in 1836, it seceded in order to form a slaveholding republic. If you don't teach that, then children are not able to understand all of the inequality that they have today. Timothy Snyder, the historian, is a historian who studies authoritarianism, and he talks about how these memory laws that we're seeing being passed all across the country, including in my home state of Iowa, where I am right now, where first they tried to pass an anti-1619 Project law, which failed, and then they came back and successfully passed an anti-critical race theory law, which has educators in the state that launched my career, where I was educated, afraid to teach the work that I have done. What they do is when you start to see these memory laws, you start to see nations that are veering towards authoritarianism, the idea of banning books, the idea that that politicians will use the power of the state to prevent the teaching of ideas that they do not like. It's not incidental, Amy, and I know you know this, that the same states that are passing these anti-critical race theory laws are also passing laws to make it harder for citizens to vote. They are passing laws that actually pull back on democracy. They're passing laws that make it harder for women to choose their own reproductive health. All of these things are related. And whether you love or hate the 1619 Project, we should not be accepting a society where the state has the power to control what texts we learn from and what ideas we can understand, and more importantly, how we understand the truth about our country.
Nicole, when you won the Pulitzer Prize for commentary for your introductory essay to the 1619 Project last year, you wrote, quote, "Ida B. Wells and I were awarded the Pulitzer on the same day. How can I not believe that the ancestors intervened on this moment? I will sit in the truth of how she, how they cleared a path for me, how they endured so that I and the 1619 Project could be." Of course, Ida B. Wells was formerly enslaved and went on to be a crusading anti-lynching journalist. She received a special posthumous Pulitzer citation for her outstanding and courageous reporting. You're co-founder of the Ida B. Wells Society for Investigative Reporting. Can you talk about her pioneering role and what this meant to receive the Pulitzer on the same day so many years later?
Absolutely. I have long said and claimed Ida B. Wells Barnett as my spiritual godmother. She was honestly the first example of a Black woman doing the type of journalism that I wanted to do, which should tell you how undiverse or non-diverse the field of investigative reporting is. I didn't actually know living examples of Black women investigative reporters when I was young. So she was a pioneering investigative journalists who really brought the scourge of lynching to a global audience. She would go into towns where a Black man or woman had just been lynched, and she would interview people and she would document. And she was actually one of the early data reporters, because she would she started to collect data on how many lynchings were occurring, what were the reasons given for those lynchings, and then what did her reporting show. She also was a true intersectional woman. She was a suffragist and had to fight both for women's rights to vote and against the racism within the suffragist movement. She was a civil rights activist. She was a co-founder of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, where she had to fight against gender discrimination as a Black woman. And so in so many ways, she was just this pioneering woman who fought for civil rights and equal rights across many fronts. And she was a woman who was largely reviled by white media. And I have in my Twitter bio that I'm a nasty, a slanderous and nasty-minded mulattress, because that's what the New York Times, where I work, called Ida B. Wells while she was engaging in her anti-lynching crusade. So I take great strength from knowing that the attacks on me and the attacks on my work are really just part of a lineage of what happens when Black women and Black women journalists dare to challenge power and challenge authority. So to receive the acknowledgement for this work about the Black experience on the same day that Ida B. Wells Barnett, who, like so many Black journalists, never received the acknowledgement that they deserved, was just deeply gratifying, because I do my work in service of them.
Nicole Hannah-Jones, I wanted to go back to your mention in the preface of your initial exposure to African-American history in a high school class with Mr. Ray Dial, and you're going to be talking with him this evening, how he initially exposed you to the history that had never been given to you previously. But this would have been sometime in the late 1980s. And I guess the fact that you had a class at all was no doubt due to the struggles of Black and brown people from the prior generation. I'm old enough to recall some of those struggles of the 60s and 70s. And particularly, for example, in 1977, there was when the ABC miniseries Roots played on national television based on Alex Haley's book. It premiered. It had record audiences across the country because back then there were basically the three television networks dominated all of television. It created a similar national debate over race to what the 1619 Project has done for this generation. But within a few years came the reactionary Reagan era, and capitalist America, as it has repeatedly throughout its history, began to rebury all those lessons. And so that another generation had to resurrect it, as you and others have done now in recent years. I'm wondering how you feel that this time will be different in terms of not reburying this history in another few years.
Well, first, let me correct the record. I'm not quite that old. I was in high school in the 90s, not the
80s. Okay.
Okay. You know, it's a very sensitive subject when you get to be a woman my age. So I think that there are a couple of differences. I mean, well, one, let me say clearly we are in a moment of backlash right now. So we know that there were the textbook wars in the 80s that Reagan really tried to do some similar things to what we're seeing now, that there was a conservative backlash against the teaching of more inclusive and honest histories. And we're seeing that. You know, as we speak, this is what we're talking about. We're seeing a wave of laws, like actual laws across the country that are trying to censor how we can talk about racial inequality and the history of racism and really the histories of people who are not white in general. So I think we have to be very concerned about the echoes of history and what that means, because otherwise we just are going to have to keep relitigating this past again and again and see this kind of perpetual backsliding. I think the difference now, though, is we just have more democratic access to information. There aren't only three news stations anymore. There are all of these different modes where people are able to get out information and access information that they didn't have before. And I don't think, you know, I'm doing my work not from a small publication somewhere, but from the New York Times. And it's not going to be possible, I think, for powerful people to completely erase the knowledge that folks are getting. In fact, you wouldn't be seeing all of these laws being passed if millions of Americans were not embracing this and wanting to learn more and really wanting to confront the truth of who we are.
Well, and specifically about this resurgence and greater attention now to anti-racism, it's occurring in corporate America. It's occurring in university campuses. Specifically, a lot of university administrators and corporate leaders are increasingly talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion. They even have a new acronym that they rolls off their lips, DEI. And there's all kinds of new research projects, foundation funds, plans to diversify staffs. And yet most of these institutions continue to pursue exploitative connections to the mass of black and brown communities around them. What, in your view, are the pitfalls of this current type of wokeness that we have to be vigilant against?
Okay, so if you follow me on Twitter at all, you know that I would never use the word wokeness. I think it is meaningless, and I think we should never be taking up the language of conservative propagandists, which is what this wokeism is coming from. But what I'll say is one thing that I do have in common with conservatives on this is I do think that DEI is generally not great, not for the reasons that they say. I just think it tends to be extremely superficial, that we don't actually see much transformation, that all of these corporations that last year with Black Lives Matter, all of these institutions, including Congress, who were saying that this was going to be a transformative moment, they did a lot of performance. So, you know, DEI trainings and turning your square on Instagram Black, that's performance. If we look a year out, more than a year out, what types of structural change did we see at any of these institutions? And the answer is almost none. So I tend to not really be that interested in those trainings. I don't think that they're harmful like the right would have you think. And I don't think that they are, you know, harming individuals or making individuals feel that they don't have a right to free speech. But I do think in general that they are ineffective and that many organizations use them as a shield against having to do the actual work.
Nicole Hannah-Jones, you write about your dad in the introductory chapter. We started in Waterloo. Let's go there again. You talk in the end of the first chapter of the 1619 Project by saying, "We were told once by virtue of our bondage that we could never be American, but it was by virtue of our bondage that we became the most American of all." Can you talk about your father and your feelings about him flying the American flag outside your childhood home and what you came to understand?
Sure. So my dad was born on a cotton plantation into a sharecropping family in Greenwood, Mississippi. He was born in 1945 at a time when black people had virtually no rights of citizenship in Mississippi. Mississippi was nearly a complete apartheid state. And he was a black man who didn't get full rights of citizenship in this country until he had lived, you know, into his 20s. So, and of course, the full rights of citizenship did not come with equality for my dad. So when I was a teenager, and my dad was a military veteran, black people serve in the military at the highest rates of all racial groups. And he was very proud of his service. And he flew a flag in our front yard. The flagpole is probably 15 feet, but in my mind, it was 100 feet tall. And I didn't understand why this black man who would live the life that he lived would display his patriotism so outwardly. It seemed to me almost demeaning to do that, to show such outward pride in a country that had never treated him with basic dignity. So I worked through this in the essay on democracy, which is the opening essay for the book, which is really talking about the unparalleled role that black Americans have played in democratizing this country, that black people, through centuries of resistance, have worked to force this country up to its founding creed. And I came to understand that my dad's pride was not in that kind of performative flag pin wearing patriotism that says America is exceptional and America is the greatest nation in the world. But it was a pride in saying our ancestors built so much of what made this country prosperous. Our ancestors' blood is in this soil. Our ancestors have fought in every war this country has waged. And our ancestors are the reason we have the semblance of democracy that we have. And no one has the right to take that heritage from us. And it goes back to that line that you just read. Black people were not given citizenship in this country until the passage of the 14th Amendment after the end of slavery. And we're not given rights of citizenship until the passage of the civil rights bills in the 1960s. And yet, because black people were the only forced immigrants to this country, because of the Middle Passage, where we were forced to lose our language, our connection to a home country, you know, any other group who immigrates here, they can bring food from their country, clothes from their country. They can write back to family members. They can go back and visit. Black people had that completely erased, which means this is our country. And we are a product of the new world in a way that no other group of people are. And I wanted us to be able to claim the heritage of the land that we built.
And Nicole Hannah-Jones, you're a much decorated journalist, won the two Polks, the Pulitzer, the Peabody. Yet you've argued that the media are failing the country during a time when they're needed the most. Could you tell us how and why that is?
Yes, this program is called Democracy Now, and I think our democracy is in danger. If you are looking, you know, the report that just came out yesterday that listed the United States as as a democracy that is backsliding for the first time in the history of that list. If you look at the more than 150 scholars of democracy who have signed open letters saying that we are losing our democracy, is eroding. If you look at the fact that Republicans are passing laws to so intensely gerrymander in their favor that they can maintain power for decades without winning the majority of the vote. If you look at the wave of voter restriction laws that we haven't seen since Jim Crow. And yet, the political reporting class, not all of them clearly, but too many of them, are still reporting on this as if we are just engaged in normal horse race politics. They're trying to report with this view from nowhere that legitimizes a political party that actually is making it pretty clear that they don't believe in democracy. And I'm very concerned about that. As a Black journalist, as a journalist who comes from the tradition of journalism that couldn't pretend to be objective and couldn't pretend that all of our institutions will hold in the face of authoritarianism, I think that we are ill prepared for the moment that we're in. I think too many political reporters just have too much faith in our political systems, and there's no evidence to back up that faith. So I just hope that before it's too late, enough of us get an understanding that we can't cover what's happening in our country right now as politics as usual. And you can't dismiss all of these scholars of authoritarianism who are raising the alarm. We've got to do better. We know that reporting the press is the firewall of our democracy, and I don't think the firewall's holding right now.
As we wrap up, I wanted to ask you about this moment that you're talking about. You've got the inquiry into the riot, the insurrection of January 6th being led by a House panel. And you've got the three trials, the Rittenhouse trial that just wrapped up, not guilty on all counts for Kyle Rittenhouse, who killed two people and critically wounded a third. You've got the Charlottesville white supremacy trial, and you've got that jury in Brunswick, Georgia now that's determining the fate of three white men, including a former police officer, a Georgia DA indicted for protecting him. But these three white men charged with hunting down and murdering 25-year-old Ahmaud Arbery. So we're in the closing arguments now, and a nearly all-white panel of 12 jurors and three alternates are hearing the rebuttal from prosecutors today. Yesterday, the defense attorney, Laura Hogue, who represents Greg McMichael, the former cop, blamed Arbery's own actions for his death. This is what she said.
Turning Ahmaud Arbery into a victim after the choices that he made does not reflect the reality of what brought Ahmaud Arbery to Satilla Shores in his khaki shorts with no socks to cover his long, dirty toenails.
That drew a gasp from the courtroom. Ahmaud's mother, Wanda Cooper Jones, left the courtroom briefly. Can you comment on what she has said and what these trials are about?
You know, that was, even for someone who doesn't tend to get shocked by the way that Black Americans can be dehumanized in the legal system and in society at large, that was just a shocking moment. And what we're seeing, I mean, I really do hope that the viewers and listeners will get the 1619 book, because what we're seeing, it's laid out in that book. This idea that Black people are a separate and distinct group of humans who are inherently suspicious, who just their presence is a lethal weapon. And so even if you have three men who are armed, who are chasing down an unarmed person, that's legitimate. The idea that random white citizens have the authority to stop and question a Black person, and if that Black person does not comply, they can use lethal force. That is a legacy of the slave patrols, which deputized all white Americans with the ability to question and stop and detain black people and make sure that they were not in white spaces where they weren't supposed to be. All that we're seeing, Charlottesville, the insurrection on the Capitol, George Floyd, the Rittenhouse trial, which, of course, goes to a long legacy of white people who fight for black lives, will receive the same poor justice that black people receive. I think we have to decide if we are going to grapple honestly with our country or not. The kind of defining tension, the defining divide of black of American life begins in 1619 with the introduction of African slavery. Even our very democracy, the idea that we are the oldest continuing democracy in the world, was predicated on excluding black people. It was predicated on a democracy that for the first 100 years or first, I'm sorry, 200 years was a democracy of white men. And now that we have a democracy that includes all kinds of people of color and women, our democracy is very frail. So I think that we are in scary times, and we are in times where it's going to require a great deal of courage on behalf of our fellow Americans. And I'm frankly just not seeing enough of it.
Well, Nicole Hannah-Jones, I want to thank you so much for spending this time with us. Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter covering racial injustice for The New York Times Magazine, creator of the landmark 1619 Project. She is the co-editor of the 1619 Project, a new origin story, and the adaption of the 1619 Project for children. It's called Born on the Water. Best of luck tonight in Waterloo. Next up, the world-renowned dissident and linguist Noam Chomsky on President Biden's foreign policy. Stay with us.
And it feels like I was born to be free.
One Day by Cleo Soule. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We end today's show with the world-renowned dissident and linguist Noam Chomsky. Nermeen Sheikh and I had a chance to speak with Noam on Monday and asked him about his assessment of President Biden's foreign policy.
Well, the trajectory is not optimistic. Biden has pretty much picked up Trump's foreign policy. He's eliminated some of the more gratuitously savage elements, like in the case of Palestine, for example. Trump was not satisfied with just giving everything away to Israeli right-wing power, do what you want, and offering nothing to the Palestinians, just kicking them in the face. He even had to go beyond that to truly gratuitous savagery, like cutting off the lifeline, the UNRWA lifeline, for Palestinians to be able to have at least minimal bare survival in the Gaza, in the Israeli punching bag in Gaza. Even that, well, Biden removed those things. Other than that, pretty much followed the same policies. On Iran, he made some verbal moves towards overcoming the crime of U.S. withdrawal from the joint agreement, but he's insisting on perpetuating Trump's position that it's the responsibility of Iran, the victim, to move towards harsher agreement, because the United States pulled out of an agreement that was working perfectly well. The worst case is the increasing provocative actions towards China. That's very dangerous. By now, there's constant talk about what's called the China threat. Even read it in sober, reasonable, usually reasonable journals about the terrible China threat. Well, what is, and we have to move expeditiously to contain and limit the China threat. What exactly is the China threat? Actually, that question is rarely raised here. It is discussed in Australia, the country that's right in the claws of the dragon. So recently, the distinguished statesman, former Prime Minister Paul Keating, did have a essay in the Australian press about the China threat. He finally concluded, realistically, that the China threat is China's existence. The U.S. will not tolerate the existence of a state that cannot be intimidated the way Europe can be, that does not follow U.S. orders the way Europe does, but pursues its own course. That's the threat. When we talk about the threat of China, we're talking about alleged threats at China's borders. China does plenty of wrong things, terrible things. You can make many criticisms, but are they a threat? Is the U.S. support for Israel's terrorist war against 2 million people in Gaza, where children are being poisoned because a million children are facing poisoning because there's no drinkable water, is that a threat to China? It's a horrible crime, but it's not a threat to China. What China, serious abuses that China is carrying out are wrong. You can condemn them. They're not a threat. Right at the same time, as Keating's article, Australia's leading military correspondent, Brian Toohey, highly knowledgeable, did an assessment of the relative military power of China and in their own region of China and the United States and its allies, Japan and Australia. It's laughable. One U.S. submarine, Trident submarine, now being replaced by even more lethal ones. One U.S. submarine can destroy almost 200 cities anywhere in the world with its nuclear weapons. China, in the South China Sea, has 4 old, noisy submarines, which can't even get out because they're contained by superior U.S. and allied force. And in the face of this, the United States is sending a fleet of nuclear submarines to Australia. That's the AUKUS deal, Australia, UK, United States, which have no strategic purpose whatsoever. They will not even be in operation for 15 years. But they do incite China almost certainly to build up its lagging military forces, increasing the level of confrontation. There are problems in the South China Sea. They can be met with diplomacy and negotiations. The regional powers taking the lead could go into the details. But the right measure is not increasing provocation, increasing the threat of an accidental development which could lead to devastating, even virtually terminal nuclear war. But that's the direction the Biden administration is following, expansion of the Trump programs. And that's the core of their foreign policy programs.
World-renowned dissident author Professor Noam Chomsky, he'll be joining us on our 25th anniversary online celebration December 7th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time with Greta Thunberg, Angela Davis, Arundhati Roy Martinez, Father Winona LaDuke, and more. Visit democracynow.org for details. And that does it for our show. The warmest of congratulations to Chirina Nadura and Hector Rios on the birth of Amihan Rios Nadura. Amihan, welcome to the world. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.